Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hey everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's terrific to have your company for another episode of the show. Now, in this episode, we're going to be taking a slightly contrarian look at the world. We're going to be having an unorthodox conversation about why disorder can actually be very good for your business. And I'm joined today by Gus Bell-Bonton, who is an alternative futurist, which is to say that he's not trying to predict the future. He will openly say no one can predict the future. But what his thesis is, what his idea is, what his message and his mission is to make sure that businesses are adequately prepared for anything that comes their way. And I think this is a really important conversation because clearly we're living through a period of immense change. Clearly the business environment we're operating in is changing on a day-to-day basis. We are seeing AI, we're seeing machine learning, we're seeing robotics, we're seeing all manner of things occurring at a pace never before imagined. And we can't possibly keep pace with all those changes, but we need to make sure we are resilient, we're nimble, we're agile, we're adaptable so that our businesses can continue to thrive. So in this conversation, we're going to have a really interesting deep dive, a bit of a meta conversation as well about what disorder is and why that can actually be a force multiplier for your business. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. Here's Gus. Gus, thanks so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us all the way from Melbourne. How's things in your world?
Oh, very good. Thank you very much. Looking forward to this.
Mate, me too. Gus, I've been scouring the internet, watching your videos, doing all those sorts of things, and we were just talking off air about some of your startups and the things you're involved with, and it's really exciting. And you're really known, I suppose, for lots of things, but one of the things I know you mostly for is preparing for the future. And it is an exciting future. It's a really, you know, time of rapid change. And I wanted to talk a little bit about preparing for the future today so that, in your words, it doesn't slap you across the face. And before we get into that, though, I wanted to ask you, how and why do you think that's so important?
I'll start with this. I think we have a slightly incorrect approach to understanding, you know, the way we go about the future. And I tell you, one thing that happens all the time is that we tend to like rely on futurists to tell us what's going to happen. Yeah. Or we look at market trends on technology reviews, or we do customer segmentation, or we do all those kind of exercises in an effort to predict the future, right? Yeah. And my claim is always that it doesn't matter how well you can predict the future. If you can't adapt your business to it,
yes,
what's the point in knowing?
Yes, yes.
Right? What's the point in knowing? And my first argument is, A, you're not going to be able to predict it. So even if you were, you can't adapt your business. But A, you're not going to be able to. And B, don't disproportionately invest your time, meaning don't spend 80% of your time trying to predict it and 20 adjusting to it. The other way around, 80% of your time learning how to adjust, 20% trying to predict it, right? And learning to adjust means how do you increase your adaptability, your agility, your, you know, your flexibility, your... So I talk a little about that. That's why when people call me a futurist, I always say, no, I'm an alternative futurist. I actually tell you that I have no idea what's going to happen.
Most dentists are pretty linear, orderly thinkers, and I'm a linear, orderly thinker. It's how we're trained. And so to bring that back to the context of, you know, predicting the future and preparing for the future, most of us try to predict the future, and as you said, it's pretty futile, and it's probably 80% of the energy that gets used where it should be 20%. I wanted to talk about why we're so enticed by trying to predict the future. I'll talk about the 80% that we should be doing, you know, in agility and flexibility in a minute. But why is trying to predict the future so attractive?
Primarily, it's born from fear, right?
Certainty.
We're just fearful of getting caught off guard or not knowing what's going to happen. Or it's born from opportunity where you go, and if only I knew, like I should be able to jump on it and capitalize and make more money than the next person or be more aware or whatever it is. I think the challenge is, like I said, how do you make sure that you don't disproportionately spend your time figuring it out and not invest in your ability to capitalize on it or adjust to it or move through it? Or I think that's where it stems from, or it's born in my view. It's natural anyway. And the only other place that it's born from is when you think you know what's going to happen, or it's been fairly stable for a long time, and all of a sudden it gets disrupted in some capacity. So when it does get disrupted, you go, shit, I've known this really well for a long time. Now it's not the same. What is the new, right? So then you start trying to predict how that thing is going to adjust. And when there's geopolitical tension and all the stuff that is happening right now, or you know, we just come out of, you know, a pandemic, of course, you're highly anxious about how to, you know. But again, I think the challenge is we think that where it's at is predicting it, where what I'm claiming is, no, where it's at is the ability to adjust to it. That's where it's at.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, predicting the future. Yeah, some people will proclaim to know exactly what's going to happen, but you're quite right, none of us do. And in fact, one of my mentors, who's a fabulous investor, always says to me, Jesse, don't try and time the market. With all the data science around, no one can predict the market. And it's the same, more broadly as well. So the question then begs, how do you strategically position yourself for a better future? And, your response is to become more nimble, more agile. So can we just talk a bit about what that means in practice?
I always say to businesses that they can never forget that all the businesses is the sum of its parts.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. A business behaves as the sum of the behaviors of the people in the business. So if you've got a business of, let's say, 8, 9, 10 people, right, and you're running your dentistry, of which the, 7 out of the 10 are, naturally grumpy people, your business is a grumpy business. And it doesn't matter what you do, and you might be the owner and you might say, guys, we need to be nicer and smile more, whatever it is that you're going to tell them. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Because these people are just like, if 7 out of the 10 are cynical people, your business is a cynical business. If 7 out of the 10 are conservative, your business is a conservative business. Like the average wins, right? So adaptability and agility is exactly the same. So if you've got 7, 8 out of the 10 people that are very adaptable themselves, your business is an adaptable business.
Mm.
Now, how do we lose adaptability? We lose it because as we get older, we start pushing novelty away from our lives.
Mm.
The older we get, the less new things we do. And you ask me, I always ask my audiences, why? And why do we do this? And everyone can figure out really quickly. We got more to lose. We're scared of failure. We are comfortable. So we go, I know how to do this. We love routines, and our brains biologically encourage us to stay with routine because it saves energy.
Yep.
And it's easy to do. So we just keep repeating the same shit over and over again. Same breakfast, same time, same thing, same way to get home, same drive, same desk, same. So the brain over time loses its tolerance to the discomfort of change, right? So then when change emerges, when the market changes, when the future becomes different, when you panic because you go, oh my God, I lost all my tolerance to discomfort and my brain can't even deal with this amount of energy. So one of the things that I do is encourage a lot of businesses that if they want to retain their adaptability is encourage everyone in your business to embrace novelty, to do new stuff as often as they can, right? And that's one of the ways to bit by bit increase that ability to adjust.
So that sounds like a culture piece to me. That sounds like a huge culture piece. And so establishing that into the business's DNA, encouraging that novelty, doing new things routinely, regularly. I shouldn't use the word routinely because that implies routine, but doing new things regularly is that way to kind of build that muscle. So what I'm hearing is you either use it or lose it kind of routine. Is that how you're thinking?
Yeah. Here's the interesting thing. And now we're going to bring, this becomes kind of fairly meta, but let's go with it.
I like meta, mate.
What happens is this. Okay. What happens is this. In every business, and it's a binary way of looking at it, and by the way, like every model on earth, you can pick them apart, right? But this is my model. This is what I, over the years, have designed or developed, in my businesses and how I do it.
Sure.
Every business has order people and disorder people.
Yep.
Effectively, the transition in innovation, when you do innovation in any business, which innovation is simply fixing problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're fixing problems.
Yep.
And when you fix a problem, you go from and you fix super basic, simple business as usual problems all the way to really complex future 20 years times problems, right?
Yep.
In 10 years time, we're going to have humanoids being dentists. Okay, great.
Without a doubt.
Sounds like a crazy problem. How is that going to work? And what about safety? And what about regulation and ethics? And sure. Eventually, we'll figure all that and it'll become, a problem that we solved.
Yep.
Right now, there is a problem that might have to do more with, the simplicity of a chair in a dentistry or a piece of equipment or whatever. It's BAU and we'll fix it. When you fix a problem, you go from disorder to order. At the beginning, when the problem is not solved, it's out of order. And then when we figure it out, we order it, right? When you move through that transition, you go from less structure to more structure, crazy to sane, unknown to known, you know, you move along. These people that are really, really good at establishing order and maintaining order, and there's people that are really, really good at creating disorder and feeding off the disorder and inventing and creating and pulling together. The truth is that novelty is effectively the opposite of whatever you're good at. Often people think that novelty is disorder, is the crazy stuff and all the new things. For me, novelty also includes doing legal stuff, doing the AICD course, reading through legal documents. That's disorder for me because my order in my mind is the craziness that I feel comfortable in craziness. I feel uncomfortable in, do you know what I mean? So when you say most of the dentists are order people sequential, sure, for the majority, what they need to do to the novelty is bring a bit of craziness and discomfort in their lives that has to do with the non-sequential world. But some people are disorder people, and what they need is the opposite. They need some of the structure in order for them to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And what you're doing in both ends is increase your tolerance to the opposite end of it.
Look, that's a really novel way of thinking about it. I'd never really thought of disorder in that way or order and disorder in that way. It's quite an interesting, and you're right. I think I'm reflecting on a couple of people who I know are a little bit on the, I suppose, creative end of the spectrum, and they thrive in that hubris of creativity, and they always need someone to kind of bring structure to their ideas, to take the ideas and make them real. You know, they make it up, other people help them make it real.
So they need to surround themselves with other people, but themselves, to increase their tolerance to change, what they need to do is actually order.
Yeah.
Because disorder doesn't increase anything for them. Disorder is like, great, give me some crazy shit, I'm good to go.
Yeah.
So that's interesting as a dynamic, because understanding that. Now, the tension in that dynamic is what makes your business retain its adaptability and discover that future. Because you don't want to get rid of the tension. If in a business you've got, you know, 9 out of 10 people that are order and only one disorder person, you might end up with a situation where the disorder person just gets eaten up and can't say anything, right? If you got the opposite, you got an opposite problem. It's like everything's crazy.
Yeah, so what I'm wondering about here is team dynamics. In your world, Gus, I imagine that your whole team is familiar with that dynamic and the tension that exists, and actually the value of that tension as well, because there is value in having...
Exactly. You don't want to get rid of it. That's right. 100%.
But what I've experienced, and I'm sure other people have experienced, is one side seeing the other side as wrong.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? And so rather than seeing it as a net positive, they see it as, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
We have, sorry, this is going to sound a little bit strange. We have the idea of, you know, the new idea is being like a butterfly coming out of its chrysalis and being, you know, fully formed into this beautiful butterfly. And then at the other end, we call the other people the butterfly crushers, like the people who take an idea and just kill it. And the point I'm trying to make is I realize now that's not a fair assessment, because we need that tension. So I wanted to ask you, how do you communicate that in a team so that everyone feels okay with their natural mode of thinking?
Yeah. Well, and also where they're at and aware of it and happy at the place. Because what happens is this, you're right, there is very little empathy and you end up with the situation of us and them.
Yeah.
And the moment you end up with the situation of us and them, you actually stop innovation from taking place, because the two opposite, and it happens in meeting where someone goes, I wonder if we can try this, and the other person goes, no, we can't afford it, or whatever, it's illegal or something. And then guess what? The disorder person goes, I'm going to double down. It should be this crazy and whatever. And the other person goes even more order. So then nothing happens. By the way, for all the audience that is listening to this, a bit of marriage counseling. This happens in marriages all the time. There's always another person and a disorder person. So, you know, great degree of empathy is important between the parts, understanding their place. Generally speaking, I always say societies in general tend to preference order over disorder.
Mm.
The way the school system is structured, the way the financial system, justice system, they tend to lean over order and observe order as more important and more valuable.
Mm.
Right? So a lot of the disorder subjects or practices or people tend to be seen as, nah, they're too crazy, they don't understand, you know, whatever. So generally speaking, in a team, depending on the sector, you need to actually, and depending on the age of the business and so on, you need to almost try to protect a little bit disorder rather than order, right? Because that's the harder bit to let breathe and give them some empathy and love and care. Now, in some other sectors, like let's say we're talking the latest crypto startups, young people doing crypto, the opposite is the case. There's mostly disorder kids running around.
They really are.
And what you need is, hey, we need some older people to just like make it happen, because otherwise we're going to continue to be rogue and be seen as, you know, this crazy bunch, when in fact we've got some really good technology here that could really solve, you know, the real problems. And it's starting to happen. But so depending on the time, the sector, the technology, that you might have a bit of a prevalence towards one or the other. But generally speaking, the medical sector is primarily order, and it's hierarchical and it's military and so on. So the challenge in that sector is actually protecting a little bit of the disorder and creating the empathy on both and realizing that they're both just as important as each other.
So I wanted to ask you about the life cycle of a business in that context, because a lot of the people that we work with look to scale their operations. Now, in dentistry, you know, it's a little bit, I suppose scaling is a word that's probably used for convenience rather than because it's necessarily an accurate description, but, you know, leverage is probably a better term. But that might start, you know, having multiple operations across different locations and so on and so forth, all those sorts of things. And the metaphor that we often use is going from being a pirate to being in the Navy. But at the same time, you know, it's about protecting, as you say, some of that pirate pirate magic. How do you know what the right balance is? How do you know what that right mix is? And I'm looking at that through, as you said, the different stages of development of a business. You know, obviously in the early stages, there's a lot of pirate and a whole lot less Navy. But when you're looking to exit your business, for example, and you're trying to find a buyer, how much Navy do they want versus pirate?
To make sure.
Just trying to ask you your thoughts around that.
Really good question. I think normally it depends a little bit on the sector you're in. So, for example, like I said, if you're in the digital currency finance, you know, crypto sector, probably the balance of power and Navy, it's different to the medical sector, right? Where you probably need. So that's number one. Like, that picture is important to understand straight up. The next picture is, depending on where you're at, also there is lengths of time and dynamics at play, like mining plays long terms, you know, where software plays really short terms and everything in between, kind of thing, right? You've got that as well. The next bit of the next layer or lens that you can look through is just the stage of the business. Yeah. So really, really, really early stage, you naturally are far more pirate, of course. The later stage in the business, you start aggregating, and the challenge is the opposite, right? When you're a pirate, you need some level of structure to be able to scale.
Yeah.
When you scaled up, the challenge is protecting the pirate DNA, because otherwise you disappear eventually. You go through the curve and then
you disappear.
And the other, exactly the same thing. Now, to me, the trick is less about trying to predict where you are in that stage, because the customer can shift really quickly and the market can shift really quickly. It's more that you never lose your ability to go from one end to the other really fast.
Right. Okay.
You can go pirate Navy, pirate Navy, pirate Navy, and you keep layering.
Yes.
Because every time you do something, you effectively are layering your pirate Navy effect, right? So let's say you've got a Navy business doing really well and you've got one operation and you're thinking effectively of opening another one in the next neighborhood over there, right?
Yep.
In that one, you're going over to pirate mode again, if you will, right?
Yes, 100%.
And you're going pirate Navy quickly with one dentist, pirate Navy quickly with two, pirate Navy quickly, and over a period of 18 months, you build that one up and then it becomes equal to this one.
Yep.
Your ability as a business to be successful is how fast you can move from one to the other and layer it versus how well you can time it. Back to your point about the timing.
So the question is the leaders of the business, right? So my question is around, how do you lead that business where you're trying to have speed of oscillation between Navy and Pirate or Pirate and Navy? What are the qualities you observe in leaders who do this well?
Well, your business that it's sitting in this neighborhood that has been established for a while, and you've been running whatever, and you've got your customers and everything is working really well, make sure that in there you've got a balance of primarily order people, some disorder, maybe one or two, but the rest are order because that's running and it's working well, whatever. In the other business, when you set it up, don't send your order person to go and help you with that one. No, send your pirate person to help you with that one. Set up a slightly different dynamic, set up a different ratio, and work with those guys over there that have the tenacity and resilience to deal with the unknown, and because you're starting up and so on, right? And that's to do with a leader that has the awareness of understanding what the team looks like and what the shape is and what people are good at and not good at.
Yeah.
In other words, you send that pirate over to that other neighborhood to build up the practice, and next to that person you put the ultimate order person, and they'll kill each other and it won't work. And the other person will try to like, no, we need process and system. The other person's going, I don't even know what the hell I'm doing. Just wait. Let me figure this shit out. You know, so a good leader has that awareness of the team. And, you know, I always say that the easier way to figure that out in the practical way is just ask them how many tabs they have open on the internet browser. If they go lots and lots and lots, they're probably pirates.
Yeah.
Right. Just remember them. And if they only got one and they're really good, just keep those as the order people and give them. Anyway, that's just one way of doing it.
I love it. Now, the question I have for you around this is dealing with setbacks and failure. Because one of the things for pirates is, yeah, just move on, right? But for the order people, like, a setback is like a dagger through the heart oftentimes, or I told you so, we should have had another Excel spreadsheet, or, you know, if we just had a better process around that, you know, that wouldn't have happened. So yeah. I wanted to ask you the inevitable question about dealing with setbacks and stuff ups, because right, they happen, right?
Now, Jesse, you put your finger on something really powerful, which I often write in my newsletters about. And people, it's a wonderful, you know, epiphany that I had, an observation that I made when I was, you know, developing all these models, is that actually innovation is asymmetric.
Yeah, okay. Tell me more.
Well, the pirate end has nothing to lose short term and everything to lose long term.
Yes.
The Navy end or the order end has everything to lose short term, nothing to lose long term.
Yeah.
So that asymmetry is what makes often the language that they both speak so different. And as a leader, you're meant to help translate that language in between the pieces.
Mm.
The CFO on this end, or the person in charge of money, goes, dude, great idea. If that doesn't work, we lose our business. Has a lot to lose short term. The pirate person or the this sort of person goes, yeah, I get it. But if we don't do this, in 10 years' time, we'll lose our business.
Yeah.
So you think in short term because you need to make sure the business runs and you can pay the bills. I'm thinking long term, make sure that everyone keeps being employed long term and we don't get taken off by AI or humanoids or whatever, right? So that asymmetry makes it very, very difficult to often compare apples with apples. The lenses and the KPIs that we run order through should not be applied to disorder.
Right.
But businesses normally have one set of KPIs or one set of lenses to look through. So we judge disorder with order, and we should never judge disorder with order. We should judge disorder with disorder and order with order. So how do you judge disorder? Is that the failure needs to be small, simple now.
Mm. So MVPs.
So really quickly, yeah, really quickly, really fast, really small, fail, iterate, learn through that.
Yeah.
How do you judge order? Sure, you've got, you know, larger KPIs, bigger things, P&Ls, cash flows, lots of other things are measures and lenses that you look through to see if your business is healthy or not.
I'm the CFO. I've got a disordered person, creative, coming up with an idea that's going to really set us up for the future. And I'm saying, hang on, dude, if this fails, you know, we could be out of business. The better approach would be to allocate some sort of money, quarantine some sort of money as an innovation fund and say, okay, this is our allocation here. Use it, fail fast, fail quickly, iterate, get better, show me proof of concept, and then we can continue to reinvest based on all that.
I'll make it even better. Normally in small business, I don't even let them do that.
Okay.
Because I say this, here's another little layer of the meta world that we're building in our minds. And if I could be drawing this, because I'm a drawer, I would be drawing all this on a wall. The pirate end, the disorder end, it's also what I call the resourceful end.
Yeah.
Not resources, resourceful.
Yes.
The order end is the resources end. So a good innovator, a good pirate, a good disorder person at the start operates on resourcefulness, not on resources. So it doesn't need money. It doesn't need anything. All it needs is a problem worth solving.
Yeah.
And if you've got a problem worth solving and you can uncover that, and you don't need money for that, you just need to be really clever and very good at observing. And you can start iterating by bootstrapping stuff together and doing it the good old resourceful way. Then at some point in time, you prove yourself as an entrepreneur or as a disorder person or as a pirate, hey, I think I've got something here. That's when you go and talk to the CFO and say, okay, maybe I need some resources now to see if I can actually prove this and get it to a certain scale. And then you get into the order and then you put resources against it and whatever. So the challenge is if you give too much resources to the resourceful end, you end up making the mistakes of judging that end with the lenses of order.
Got it.
And you know, or you, the CFO forces the entrepreneur to say, build me a business case. And then what happens in the business case? You lie. Because the only way to make it stack up is to lie. So you end up going, oh, if only we capture 2% of the market, of this much market, it's going to make this much. And then you end up lying through your teeth. Yeah. So the better way of doing is, mate, go to the other neighborhood, bootstrap the shit out of it, set yourself up in the smallest possible shop, you know, whatever you want, as resourcefully as you can. Right? And I don't know what the equivalent is for dentistry. You might still need a chair. But
you know, here's what happens, though. This is something, a problem we see all the time, is we see someone say, I'm going to go and set up another location, or I'm going to go and do this, and they'll overinvest.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They'll pimp it out with everything, and they'll have CAD comb coming out of their ears. They'll have the latest in imaging technology. And like you say, we don't know if it's going to work yet. So I would be inclined, using this methodology, to get a secondhand dental chair.
Exactly.
Some IKEA cabinetry or whatever it is, and, you know, and try it out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the challenge and the mistake that we made. I'll tell you an example back in the day, way back in the day, an equivalent of Boost Juice in Argentina.
Yep.
So typical mistake of a young entrepreneur that didn't know. What did I do? I built a business case. I did some market research. So I would go and ask people, do you like juice? Yes. Wonderful. I've got a market. How much do you like it? A lot. Great. And then I'm like, how many people drink juice? Oh, my God, there's so many. If only I capture 1% of these, I'll be a multimillionaire. This is so easy, right? So guess what I do? I go and raise capital and put some of my capital and I get myself a shop. I buy the blenders, the fridges, set it up. And then last 2 years, and then eventually I fail. The resourceful way of doing that is
pop up.
I make myself a little tiny cart with two bicycle wheels and my mom's blender, and I cross different corners. I talk to people. You get the point. That end is resourceful. This end is resources. The two ends need to have different judgments and different ways. It's asymmetric. Therefore, play different games in them. Be very careful that you don't end up in a situation where you're trying to, like you said, you already know how order works, so you go and set up and you with exactly the same structure and system. No. You're overkilling it.
Yeah.
Small, simple now.
I want to change gears for a second if I can, Gus, because one of the people whose work, whether you love him or hate him, he's immensely successful, is Jeff Bezos. And Amazon, amazing company, AWS, Amazon Prime, the whole nine yards, right? And one of his tenets is to think about, when people say, what's the latest, what's coming? He'll say, well, that's one way of thinking about it, but I also think about what's staying the same and looking at those things as well. So I wanted to ask you where that thinking fits into business. And I understand we are going through periods of change, but I also wonder, is there value in that line of thought, do you think?
My fear always is that, one of the big mistakes that businesses make, and I talk a lot about this, and why it's so hard to bring novelty into a business or into your life, is because we're really terrible at letting go.
Yeah.
We can't let go, right? So in business, we keep doing processes, systems, software, training material, principles, frameworks, sacred cows, that we keep doing it because we've always done it this way and it's always worked, so we just keep doing it because. And the truth is, you should learn to let go. I think the best way to know if something should stay is by letting it go. And if it comes back, okay, this one is a good one, should stay.
Yeah.
So I would encourage people less about thinking how to discover what needs to stay and more about really favoring letting go. And if it comes back, it's because it was worth it. But gosh, if you're clever enough, like Bezos and what he set up, maybe you could do it. But
I wanted to share this thing with you. I found it a little while ago. It was introduced to me years and years ago. It's called a creative whack pack, and it's written by a guy called Roger, I can't pronounce his surname, Von Och or Och, probably a Dutch name. Anyway, in here is a deck of cards basically designed to encourage creative thinking. And my favorite card in this whole deck of cards is Kill a Sacred Cow. And and it's, so to your point about letting things go, and if they're meant to be, they come back. I think that is a really interesting thing. And when you think about businesses that have innovated really well, I think Apple, under the stewardship of Steve Jobs at least, innovated quite well. And the sacred cow that he killed was the iPod, right? And the iPod got dismantled, discontinued, whatever, and it was replaced by the iPhone. So I wanted to talk to you just again about the courage of being able to let go of something that is probably currently serving you well from a monetary point of view, but you know it's not going to serve you well into the future. And I'm thinking Blockbuster Video. They could have bought out Netflix in the day. Yahoo could have bought Google in the day, but they were holding on to the status quo, and it ultimately led to the failure of their business. So now taking those big, bold decisions does require some courage. I just want to ask you a bit about the role of courage in this conversation.
Huge. I think that the challenge, though, is what I said before about small, simple now.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, because we favor order, and once order is established and product market fit is established, we scale things, we tend to make things complex big and leave them for later. And so that's the opposite to small, simple now, complex big later. And that complexity and that scale increases the size of the courage we need to have.
Mm.
So that kind of scale of courage is scary, where if you're talking about courage at a small, simple now end, like the courage to be given a bike and saying, right, we're going to go to the craziest bike park and you're going to do 30-foot jumps. It's enormous, right? But if someone gives you a bike and said, hey, learn to roll this around and hold them to your siblings and onto the fence and figure it out, it's not that scary, right? You know, at worst, you scuff your knee, you know, whatever, with the other one, at worst, you. So I think that's one of the disproportionate things that we do in business, that because everything is favoring order and everything's favoring that scale and everything, you end up in this place where, you know, of course, courage becomes big as well. The other bit is that you need to bring novelty into your life in such scale that it's in accordance to your tolerance and your, you know, if I go and drive a Formula One car right now, the courage will be enormous. I don't have that because it's likely that I'll end up smashing myself. Where if I'd start, you know, a small, simple night and move my way through it, I think it'll be a lot more conducive to that kind of stuff.
Gus, just as we wrap things up, I wanted to get your advice, if I may, for those younger audience members who might be thinking about starting business. Maybe they're not yet in business. So one bit of advice that you think would be really helpful for those people at the beginning of their journey. And then another piece of advice for the more seasoned business owner who may have pushed novelty away for a bit too long, or maybe has let that novelty muscle weaken over time. I wonder if you had just a bit of advice for each of those two segments of the audience.
So the younger generation, something on the lines of making sure that you don't let anybody else set up your success metric.
Yeah.
You set it up yourself.
Yep.
Be careful that you're not chasing somebody else's
dreams.
Yeah. They're yours to own and yours to define and yours to redefine as often as you want. And there's nothing wrong with you just resetting your own expectations of yourself.
Yep.
Higher, lower, change them all the time. It's all good to go. And that's important because that, to me, has a lot to do with your mental well-being and your happiness. If the gap in between those two becomes too big, you end up in this place of despair where, you know, whatever, this success that you're chasing, which somebody else kind of influenced you to believe that it's the one they need to chase, is at odds with whatever it is, the access you have to right now, or your ability right now, or your skill or experience or whatever, and you end up with this dissonance that makes you on a daily basis feel incredibly unhappy about where you're at, because where if you set that up correctly, you know, it should be a journey of that is far more pleasant. And then to the older generation or someone that is well seasoned, and you know, is if you can master if you can't let go, if you're struggling with creating the space to bring that novelty into your life, and you can't even do it in small, simple now steps, surround yourself with those that do it and soak it up.
Yeah.
Soak it up as much as possible. You need to feel at least once a week, once a month, a degree of discomfort and anticipation that makes you nervous and a bit scared.
Mm.
And if you haven't felt that for a while, then you're standing too still.
I was mentioning off air a book called Deliberate Discomfort, which is one of the military training books. And one of their whole things that I use to train Navy SEALs with is to put them in, you know, moments of discomfort or periods of time of discomfort over and over and over again for the reason you discussed, which is to build that muscle to become comfortable being uncomfortable.
Exactly. And comfortable and the tolerance to nothing phases you. And to be honest, I always ask my question to my audience, it's like, how many of you on crypto? Trigger would end up, go and buy some crypto.
Yeah.
$20, who gives a shit, whatever. Just learn about a digital wallet, learn what a blockchain is. Do it for novelty purpose. You know, who owns a 3D printer? No one. Buy a 3D printer, they're not expensive. Start printing some shit. I don't know. Virtual reality goggles. Have you written an algorithm? Can you play? But equally, I say sometimes, have you ever been naked in public? If you haven't, go get naked. Like, go and do shit that you've never done. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, whatever. Have you done a live new drawing? No. Do it.
Yeah.
Do something that you've never done, you know, just for the sake of making your muscle practice that discomfort.
Yeah. 100%. I love it. Gus, thank you so much for being such a thought-provoking guest. I knew when we booked you in, this was going to be a really stimulating and interesting conversation and an out-of-the-box conversation too, but I think a very, very important conversation because the world is changing and the status quo is not going to exist. It never has, and the illusion of the status quo is perhaps a bit of a really dangerous thing. And so the fact that we know that change is here, the fact that we're more aware of it than ever, but the fact that we're perhaps ill-equipped for it, I think is a real problem. And I really applaud the work that you're doing, helping business owners in particular equip themselves for the inevitable changes that are coming and bring that future towards you, as you say, and step into that discomfort. Because I think ultimately when you step into that discomfort, you'll find freedom from all sorts of things. And, you know, freedom lies in being bold, as Robert Frost said. So I appreciate you, mate.
Amazing. Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.